The history of television is a history of failure.
For every television series that lasted years and years, there were dozens that lasted only one season or less.
But did they deserve to die? Or were they canceled too soon?
Everybody, and welcome back to Canceled Too Soon, the podcast where we review television series that lasted only one season, maybe even less. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic, and everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I too am a critic, and I'm here to talk about the 70s.
Yeah, cool time when everyone's bottoms were belled and all of their...
Well, you're thinking of the 60s, but all right.
They still had them.
I guess they still had them.
Yeah, you can buy bell-bottoms now if you really want.
We're talking about the 1970s, and we're talking about a very notable film director at an early point in his career.
Yeah, so there's a certain filmmaker you may have heard of. His name is Steven Spielberg.
He directed Bridge of Spies.
Uh-huh. Always.
And Ready Player One.
Yeah.
And those, nothing else that's really notable.
Yeah, a few other obscure oddities here and there. He's actually rather a big deal. Steven Spielberg is considered one of the great filmmakers, period. And you know what? He's a very mainstream filmmaker, and you might think that, you know, a sort of a snobby film critic would, like, turn their head and go, Spielberg. Spielberg's great. Excuse me. I don't like everything he's ever done, but he's a very talented filmmaker.
He's done some quite bad films, in fact. But yeah.
I don't disparage
any of his successes.
Yeah, and people forget sometimes that although Spielberg actually had a relatively quick journey from guy who'd never directed a movie before to the director of the biggest movie of all time at the time, Jaws, he actually did work his way through television. And he worked his way up doing episodes of TV shows like Night Gallery. Mm. Or didn't he do a Marcus Welby? Am I crazy?
He did a Columbo episode as well.
He did a Columbo episode. He did an episode of Marcus Welby, MD. He did shows that people have long forgotten, like Owen Marshall, Counselor at Law. Of course.
That hit.
And two episodes of The Psychiatrist, which is actually only 7 episodes long, and we should totally check that one out.
Spielberg directed then a substantial percentage of those episodes.
And then after doing some TV, he started moving more into TV movies, and that's where his first big breakout was. There's a movie called Duel, which is absolutely badass, and you should totally see Duel if you haven't seen it already. It's about a guy driving on the road in the desert, and he, like, cuts off a guy in a big rig, and the guy in the big rig decides to destroy him.
But we never really see the driver, so it's like the big rig itself is the thing trying to destroy him.
Yeah, it's really suspenseful. Mm. It's absolutely awesome. It plays great. It was released theatrically, like, overseas, because it just was that good.
It's considered a TV movie here in the United States. Mm-hmm. Did you ever see the Tiny Toons spoof of Duel?
It's great.
From Night Ghoulery?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a Plucky Duck is being chased by the truck. This is one of the best visual gags I've ever seen.
And it's appropriate to put it in Night Ghoulery because he did a couple episodes of Night Gallery. He did one of the segments in the pilot, which is this deliciously ironic thing about someone who cannot see, and they, like, decide to get new eyes all gross and ghoulish. But there's a twist, and I'm not going to ruin it for you. You should check it out.
They belong to a serial killer, don't they?
It's more bitter than that.
It's actually the premise of the Toby Hooper film, part of Body Bags.
Oh, yeah.
The segment that Toby Hooper directed was Mark Hamill got new eyes, and they were serial killer eyes.
I've seen that a few times. Mm-hmm. The old chestnut of I got a transplant, but the transplant was from a serial killer. Mm-hmm. That's been going around for many decades. I think the best version of that I've ever seen is Body Parts with Jeff Fahey.
Yeah, Jeff Fahey gets a serial... The serial killer dies, and they just sort of, like, chop him up and use his whole body. So
someone gets a leg, someone gets an arm.
A bunch of different people. Yeah, get get serial killer powers.
But they all start getting, like, flashbacks to the dude's murders, and Jeff Fahey is, like, a nice family man, and he's very disturbed by what's happening to him. And what I love about that movie is you think you know where that movie is going, and you do not. That movie goes completely off the rails in the last third, and it's amazing, and you should totally watch it. I love that movie. But so Spielberg started doing TV movies. He did Duel. Everyone knows Duel. And then he did some TV movies that nobody ever talks about. The next one he did right after Duel. And you would think Steven Spielberg just made his name. He just made Duel. Duel's a big deal. You'd think the next thing he did would get a lot of attention and still be really well known. Especially considering that it's a haunted house movie starring Darren McGavin. Who at the time was, you know, Kolchak.
Kolchak.
It was around the time he was Kolchak. I'm just going to say it. The movie Something Evil is not discussed very often because it stinks. I have seen it. It is not a good film. It is a very, really kind of dry and fusty kind of thing. The ending is kind of weird, and I guess it gets kind of fun towards the end, but it does not work. And that's the reason you've probably never heard of that. And then before he made his proper theatrical movie debut in the Sugarland Express, he had one more TV movie, except this wasn't just a TV movie. This was a pilot episode for an ambitious drama starring Martin Landau as a investigative reporter on television in a 60 Minutes type program. And in the pilot episode, he uncovers what may be a vast conspiracy involving an upcoming Supreme Court candidate. And this is a failed pilot called Savage.
Ready three. There's the time. All right, we're right on it. Coming up. 6 seconds. Give me a cigarette.
But you said...
Don't argue. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Slide.
Cue titles.
Ready one. Take one.
Good evening. This is Paul Savage.
Music.
His name is Savage.
His name is Savage.
Yeah.
Oh, that's too easy.
There are good shows that are named after people. You know, Columbo.
Yeah.
Murder, She Wrote. It was Angela Murder, She Wrote.
And Andrew, was it it's hyphenated?
It's hyphenate. Of course it's a hyphenate. It's Murder, She Wrote. She Wrote.
Murder, She Wrote.
Murder, She Wrote, right. Yeah.
Of the Bridgeport, She Wrote.
The kerning was messed up on the ads, and they decided to just live with it. No, but there's a lot of perfectly good shows named after people. But sometimes you can tell that they start with the cool sounding name.
Yeah.
And it has, like, Columbo is not a cool name. Columbo's just a name.
Yeah.
It's not like a badass name.
Or like Rockford at least is a cool name.
Yeah, but
the Rockford Files.
But it's also just a name people have. Whereas Beretta? No one has that name. If they do, like, they can you imagine if you had to live up to that name? Ridiculous.
It's like when Adam West was talking about, no, that was Brannigan. No, that was Bennigan. No, that was Beretta.
There were a lot of, in particular, cop shows at the time, or detective shows, that were just named after the lead character. Kolchak is another one. And the names were kind of distinctive, or maybe they were cool. And this is clearly of a piece with that. It's a bad name. He's not a savage person. In fact, he's actually very disciplined and controlled. You would think that if he's playing, like, this investigative journalist, and the show is called Savage, he would be maybe a disreputable investigative journalist or a journalist who care about the consequences of his actions and just wanted to give you the truth, and that's why they call him Savage. And no, his name is Paul Savage.
His name is Paul Savage, and he's like a hard-hitting investigative reporter. Mm-hmm. He's like not Arlie Ermey. He's the actor. Edward R. Murrow was the character I was thinking of. Sort of like Edward R. Murrow in a lot of ways. He's
highly respected, very
highly
famous.
Respected. He comes from this era of TV where you could hire somebody just to be smart on television.
Yeah.
And that was the shtick.
They didn't have to, like, look sexy or necessarily truss it up with a lot of melodrama. He was just, he's good.
Yeah, people would just...
You trust him. He knows what he's talking about.
Do intelligent.
Yeah.
And, And he leads up a very small investigative team. His producer is Barbara Bain,
mm-hmm.
Or Gail Abbott is the character. She's played by Barbara Bain. Mm-hmm. And they also have
you might remember from Mission Impossible.
Yeah. And there's also a young Steven Spielberg type, the cameraman, who's kind of also helping them. He's sort of like their sidekick.
Yeah, and he's a really, really great photographer, and he has a knack for catching things that just happen to be important. Mm. Like, there's a scene later on in the movie where they go to a motel to interview some people, and he sees some people leaving the hotel, and he just starts filming them, and it turns out he filmed, like the FBI quietly arresting somebody and trying not to get noticed. And so he's just got a good eye.
Immediately, yeah.
He's got a really good eye. So that's cool. The show, or the pilot, had a really good pedigree in the writer's room. It was written by three people. Mark Rogers, who had a long history in television. He also wrote the screenplay to an amazing William Castle film called Let's Kill Uncle, which, if you've never seen it, is just this like really ghoulish horror movie for kids about a kid who inherits like millions of dollars. This is in the 60s. And his uncle is supposed to take care of him. And his uncle was an assassin in World War II. And he decides he's going to kill his new nephew. And he tells his nephew about it. And he's like, I have to kill you. You're very charming, but you're not $5 million charming. So I'm going to try to kill you. But it can't look like murder. It has to look like an accident. That gives you a fighting chance. Maybe you'll kill me first. Really great.
Oh, God bless William Castle.
Really, really great movie. Yeah. It's also written by William Link. William Link created Columbo, created Murder, She Wrote, and it's also written by Richard Levinson, who co-created Murder, She Wrote and co-created Columbo. These are, like, TV royalty.
Yeah, and they had... And this was around the time they were making hits. This wasn't, like, before or after.
They were still hardworking and everything. And not
that they were resting on their laurels. My point is they were a hot commodity.
They were certainly well-respected, and... You know, every TV producer usually goes through some sort of fallow period. You look at some of the super producers, like your Stephen J. Cannells or your Glenn A. Larsons or whatever, and between every giant thing that they've done, they do a couple of manimals, you know, where it's like, it was a thought, we tried, didn't work out, the next one will, you know? And this is one that didn't work out, obviously. We'll talk about why we think that is. So, co-stars Barbara Bain, and I actually think... this one opens like it opens in an interesting way. It opens like a Hitchcock movie at like a passport photography place where a young woman is getting her passport done, and then a man is mysteriously tailing her and trying to find out why she's getting her passport taken. Is she leaving the country? And then we cut to the TV studio where the show is about to go on live in like 45 seconds,
and it's filmed in that just wonderfully energetic Spielbergian sort of way where there's a lot of fast edits. There's a lot of little bits of incidental dialogue that don't really overlap, but it sounds like there's a lot really going on.
Which is amazing because there's very little going on. Yeah. It's just getting ready to shoot a TV show, which is exciting, but not that exciting.
The excitement is really high, though. Like, there's energy in the room. Spielberg is expert at that kind of thing.
Yeah. Spielberg is working with cinematographer Bill Butler, who would go on to shoot Jaws.
Mm.
And also did a ton of classic movies. He shot Grease. He shot The Conversation. He shot One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He shot several of the Rocky movies. He was the visual consultant on Secret of Nim. He shot the original Child's Play. Like, just a really accomplished cinematographer. And you can tell, we've watched a lot of TV movies, and we've watched a lot of TV shows from the 1970s.
Mm.
And there's this stigma we have against a lot of TV movies of the era where it's like, oh, they're cheap. You know, they're kind of thrown together. Sometimes, but that not unilaterally. And there's a lot of them that actually do have a lot of ambition, a lot of filmmakers who are trying to prove something. And it's pretty clear that Spielberg, even though he'd already made Duel, and it's my understanding that he wasn't like super excited about this project, he clearly didn't want to half-ass this. He wanted to prove that he was turning this into a real movie.
Yeah.
And the opening is a really excellent condensation of that, where we're going to take just prepping to do a show. There's a ticking clock. Will Martin Landau's helicopter land? Will he get there in time? And he gets there like 2 seconds before the film's cameras start to roll. And you get a lot of business, you get a lot of people behind the scenes, a lot of wild camera angles, but it doesn't feel like random and we found it all in the editing room. It felt like we wanted to convey chaos, but do it in a very controlled way.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a really, really great opening, and actually reminded me a bit of Orson Welles's F for Fake, when he's like filming like the inside of an editing bay, and he's just trying to make the process of filmmaking look exciting by sort of chopping it into the tiniest pieces possible to just create this frenetic look, even though if you were just looking at someone working at a desk, it would just be like click,
right,
click, snip. But if you go click, close up, snip, all of a sudden it seems really exciting and dynamic, and Spielberg's doing that really expertly. So the plot kicks in when there's going to be a new Supreme Court justice. As a guy, his name is something. I looked. It's in here somewhere. I forget his name.
Will Geer.
Will Geer. Thank you. Will Geer is, he's next in line to be the Supreme Court. He's been nominated, and it looks like it's going to be pretty clear sailing. Mm. They're just going to check this guy out, ask a few questions, maybe interview his wife. Maybe there's an interesting story there. What's the angle? How do we find an angle? And then while Savage is just having a drink and eating his dinner one night, the young woman from the opening of the film comes up to him and says, "I've been having a sordid affair with that man, and I have photographic evidence, and I would like $5,000. And he's like, "I'm sorry, what?"
Let me put my sandwich down. Will Geer is, first of all, has an enormously long filmography. He's been in dozens and dozens of movies. But he is known to me because of his theater out in Topanga Canyon here in Southern California.
Oh.
The Will Geer Theatricum Botanicum.
Oh, yeah.
It's this beautiful little outdoor theater out in the thicket. And there's no backdrop. It's just sort of, you get to, the look up the side of the mountain.
That's cool.
It's essentially a space that was invented to put on productions of A Midsummer Night's Dream, and they do a lot of Shakespeare there. It's actually a really, really great venue.
If you've never been there, you might know him from The Waltons. He played Grandpa Walton. Mm. He was also in Jeremiah Johnson, and just look him up. He's been in a ton of things.
Yeah. His name is Riker in Savage.
Yeah, that took me a second. I was like, so this young woman says, "Hey, I got all the dirt. I got all the scoop. And I want you to give me $5," which is actually not a lot of money for what really could be a gigantic news story, a huge scandal, torpedo, like this big political move, basically potentially change the fate of the entire country. $5,000? Yeah, that's more money in the 70s, but it still seems pretty low.
What a naive time that a Supreme Court justice with some kind of scandal in his past could prevent him from serving.
We need to talk about the ending, actually. That's one of the things I have an issue with in this show. But we'll get there. We'll get there. So Martin Landau is, of course, very interested and curious, but he's got to think it over, and he talks it over with his producers. And by the time he has come to any sort of conclusion, she's dead. She has fallen off of a window. Wink.
Yeah, she fell from a balcony, but was it murder or not? And
we'll find out eventually, won't we?
Now,
keep watching Savage.
Paul Savage is, what I appreciate is he's really quick moving. He sees something and there's no torture, there's no confusion, there's no outrage. It's just, okay, this happened. We got to take these steps to figure out what's going on here, because clearly there's some kind of mystery. There's no meeting. They just all agree.
Yeah.
In fact, that's the thing I like, is that the three main investigative characters are always on the same page. They rarely need to confer.
Yeah.
They just all know what needs to be done, and they're already in season 8.
Yeah, there's no hackneyed thing. There's a thing they do in a lot of TV shows and sometimes movies where the storytellers want to introduce us to a world where everyone knows each other and is working like a well-oiled machine. And so oftentimes the narrative trick you do is you introduce a new character into that dynamic, and then we'll be introduced to that dynamic through that person's eyes. And it sounds like a good idea until you realize it almost never works, because everyone has to stop what they're doing to inorganically explain what they're doing. And it ruins the vibe. It ruins the overall ensemble feel that you're going for. And it feels really, really clunky. And 9 times out of 10, the character you created just to have things introduced to them is completely unimportant to the story.
Yeah,
Hellboy syndrome.
Yeah, we were Myers was the name of that character. For a brief period, we were calling that Myers syndrome after the useless protagonist of the movie Hellboy.
Yeah, a character who was super important in Hellboy, and like they talked him up and he got to be the voiceover narration. The movie's called Hellboy, but it's actually about this Myers guy, and at the end he takes over John Hurt's job, and oh man, it's gonna be great to really follow this Myers guy. Hellboy 2 comes along and it's just like, we didn't like him, so he's working in Alaska now, and that's it. He's out of the story completely with one line of dialogue when he was the protagonist last time. Why? Mm. He served his function and now he's gone.
We can accept now that we live in a world with a Hellboy and a Fishman and just spend time with them.
Yeah, I agree. I really like this dynamic. It reminds me of a Michael Mann movie where you're just immersed in a world where everyone knows their job and does their job.
I was going to compare it to David Mamet's Spartan. Spartan, which was about CIA guys. Val Kilmer plays a CIA guy, and he has a few scenes with other CIA guys, and I have no idea what they're talking about, and I like that. It's all just shop. Like, they understand their own.
Was it CIA, or was he, like, Secret Service?
It was some sort of government organization.
Yeah. Great movie, Spartan. Please see it. It doesn't get talked about enough. But yeah, it's a good example.
They're so laid back, and they're so, baseline communicative when it comes to the things they need to say to one another, that it actually becomes a little bit difficult to follow what's going on.
A little bit.
It's like, oh, they see something and they just sort of split and start investigating. It's like, I would appreciate a little exposition.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. I looked up a review of this from, this aired on March 31st, 1973. The review that I saw from, I think it was Hollywood Reporter, said the problem with it is that there's too much exposition. And I'm like, it's a mystery. So they're talking about the story a lot. That is not the same as exposition. Mm-hmm. Also, I like that they just threw us into this and just have everyone like just talking about their job and stuff. I like that they're not taking a break all the time to deal with their baggage. Oftentimes, that can be a movie's problem, that it's just too fast paced. We don't get to know them. Here, they're about their work. If a character isn't about their job and all you see them doing is their job, then it's kind of boring to see him do it. But here, what are these people? They're reporters by trade and by lifestyle. So seeing them work is exciting. And yeah, it's a little hard to follow sometimes, but I find it usually clicks back into place after a scene or two. Mm. So I was never lost for very long.
Yeah.
Which I appreciated.
I mean, I value that that really casual nature, and I like being lost in shop. But at the same time, I do like little tastes of clarity every now and again.
The story basically they start investigating. They find out that this young woman's apartment was way too expensive for her, and it was being paid for by like a mysterious company. Mm-hmm. And so they're trying to figure out who was paying for this woman's apartment that is entirely above her pay grade. And they start pulling out the threads, and they find out that there is this rich guy. Basically, he's like the Koch brothers. He's incredibly wealthy, and he wants to influence politics. Yeah. He doesn't necessarily want to be a politician. He just wants to influence them. He wants to put himself in a situation where he has power over the political system without having to deal with the actual political system, which theoretically has checks and balances that would prevent him from being able to do whatever he wanted.
Rich people getting involved in politics. What a wild fictional story.
Yeah.
After All the President's Men came out, I feel like the lid was kind of blown off a lot of this stuff, and it became fodder for stuff like TV movies.
I just realized something. We got a cast member wrong.
Oh, was
Will Gear was not the judge.
Oh, Will Gear was the rich guy.
Will Gear was the rich guy. All right. I followed your lead because you seemed so confident. The judge is named Judge Daniel Stern. He is played by actor Barry Sullivan. We're going to leave this in because Pobody's nerfed. But Barry Sullivan was in a ton of stuff. At the time, he'd been in the movie Earthquake, or he was just about to be in the movie Earthquake. He was in The Bad and the Beautiful. He had a long, 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 long history of credits. And his wife is played by Louise Latham. She's not super important to the story at first, but she gets one of the last words, which is an interesting scene, and I want to talk about it. They're trying to investigate this guy, and they tell him. They said, "Listen, we're running out of leads. We don't have a lot to go on. Mm-hmm. Let's just call the guy and ask. Hey, did you have an affair with this lady?" And they call the guy up, and he's at a birthday party for his wife, and he leaves to talk to the Savage, and he's like, "Okay, this looks bad." But look, I met this lady at a party. We had dinner. I helped her out a little. Is that really so bad? And then Savage keeps pulling out the threads and he realizes that this party was put on by this really rich guy who was trying to attract influential people and trying to encourage the women at his party, some of whom worked for him, to sleep with them and then put them in a compromising situation that he could then leverage for political gain.
Yeah.
So whether or not the judge actually was corrupted is a question that the show never really answers. But he was put himself in a position to be, and therein lies the ethical conundrum.
Either way, he's compromised.
He's compromised on some level, certainly. But the question, it's an ethical question that is posed to Savage by the end. Everything in the middle, it's mostly just business. Okay, so there's we meet a woman who knew the murder victim. She's doing a commercial. And so we visit the set of the commercial, and it's a lot of good business. We meet the billionaire. The billionaire is like one of the, you know, like in mystery stories where you meet a new character and they're always in the middle of doing something that tells you a lot about their character. But you realize it's not so much telling you a lot about their character as it is the writer is trying to make a scene not boring. Yeah, so he's looking at his classic books.
It's an illuminated manuscript. Yeah, so he has a whole collection.
I have a Gutenberg Bible. I have a million first editions. Okay. Are you not impressed? Exposition, exposition, exposition. And now you're out of the room.
Well, that was also a good character moment for Paul Savage, because he recognized the books and he didn't care.
Yeah, it's not a big deal for him. He's not impressed.
He's not distractable.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that
money or fame. He's got fame. He doesn't care about that.
Had this gone to series, there probably would have been scenes where people try to distract him, like, I can blackmail you, or here's my sexy secretary, or some such thing to try to get him to, like, lose his train of thought, and he never would. That'd probably be a running gag of the show.
It's a good gag, actually. We need more stalwart heroes who represent... people make mistakes in real life, but sometimes you want characters who represent the ideal so that you have something to aspire to.
Yeah. I think Paul Savage does it well, and I think Martin Landau plays it well.
He's good.
I think he's really... straightforward, very steel trap, kind of cold-minded kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
But that's an intriguing guy because he's always going to be on the task at hand. You know where he's coming from. The director of the commercial that you mentioned was that weaselly little guy from Young Frankenstein.
Oh, yeah. Mr. Frankenstein. Isn't it true that your uncle... Yeah, that guy.
I've seen him like crop up in supporting roles here and there. I like him.
We did an episode of one of our shows on Patreon. It's called Not on Disney Plus, and we talk about movies that should be on Disney Plus but mysteriously are not. And one of the films that we had that we reviewed on that, I think last year, was The World's Greatest Athlete, and he played the weaselly like college professor who's trying to get the coach fired because he enlisted Tarzan, played by Jan Michael Vincent, to play for their track and field team. You know, it's a silly film.
Yeah, the actor is named Danny Goldman, probably best known for playing Brainy Smurf.
Yeah, which, honestly, Brainy Smurf, I'm going to say this right now. The Smurfs, iconic, not great storytelling. Can we agree on that? They're just kind of, I'm not being insulting. They're just not, they're not super ambitious.
The original comics were much better than any of the TV or movies.
From what I've read, that's totally true. But Brainy Smurf. I like Brainy Smurf. I don't necessarily like him as a person. I don't know if I want to hang out with him.
No, he's a smug jerk.
But he's a character who is a protagonist in a story. He's never the bad guy. He might be insensitive, maybe, but he's never the bad guy. And yet he's unlikable. He's an unlikable good guy.
Yeah.
And that's something that is not in a lot of narrative fiction, where you're just willing to make a protagonist. It's like he's like the third or fourth lead of the Smurfs on any given episode. But he's there. He's always there. And he's just kind of a piece of crap. Like, he's just like, just looks down on everybody.
He's smug. Yeah.
But he's never wicked or anything. I remember Eddie Izzard had a whole bit about how Shaggy and Scooby were great characters in literature because they're protagonists, but they're cowards. And that's really rare.
Yeah.
And he equated them to Falstaff because it's like, it's that level, because it's an atypical character. So I like Brainy Smurf and Starscream, for me, are like the two 80s animated characters who I actually have a lot of respect for as characters, if not as people.
Starscream was a villain, so that made a little bit more sense.
But also very Shakespearean, very Richard III.
I suppose so.
Yeah.
Sort of sniveling, amoral sidekicks.
Yeah. Well, I guess more of an Iago. But anyway.
Brainy Smurf's in Savage. He has a brief scene.
He's fun. He's always fun.
He's smug and he's condescending. He's like four lines of dialogue, but he's smug and condescending.
He knows how to take his scene and run with it.
Yeah.
So it all boils down to they figure out everything going on. The actress who was working on that commercial, directed by Brainy Smurf, is basically willing to talk to Savage about all of the illicit dealings that this millionaire/billionaire is up to. And because of that, the millionaire/billionaire's bodyguard is ready to kill her, just like he killed the other lady.
Mm.
She is waiting in Savage's studio in the dead of night.
And this is a pretty good climax.
It's really well photographed. The whole thing is well photographed. There's this like really great shot of like at the funeral where this actress shows up and she's got her veil. And like there's this great side shot of her, pure profile shot, behind the veil, looking very moody. And then there's a shot of Martin Landau looking at her from the side. And it's almost like a shot from Persona. And then the veil is only covering his face. It's like, this is really well photographed. This is a good looking film. And this whole sequence at the end where she's in this TV studio and the killer turns out the lights and he's shadowing her and you see his silhouette really large in the foreground and her silhouette really small in the background.
She's like backlit so he actually can see them in really stark shadows.
It's really good looking.
Yeah.
The Spielberg guy is... got some potential, I think.
He might go on to make some pretty big movies.
Yeah.
Movies like Ready Player One.
Yeah.
But of course, Paul Savage is there tailing the killer.
Yeah.
So he ends up getting the drop on him.
Yeah, and he says that, I've been filming you this whole time. There's no point in killing anybody. And he guys like sort of stymied. He's like, oh, shit, it was kind of stupid to kill someone in a TV studio.
And he's in front of a camera and he doesn't know what to do. Yeah.
So Paul Savage takes his gun away. And then he just says, by the way, the cameras weren't rolling. Bye.
It's like,
gotcha.
Well, he explains it all.
He's
like,
Savage.
It takes 30 minutes for one of these cameras just to warm up. So yeah, even if I had flipped it on right when you entered, it still wouldn't be good to go. Yeah. Also, we don't send things out live just like that. It's actually
just
like all
randomly.
It's a big kind of complicated process.
People are like, hey, I was watching When Worlds Collide.
When
Worlds Collide. I was watching When Worlds Collide at 2 a.m. Why am I all of a sudden watching this woman getting stalked in a movie studio? Weird.
Yeah.
But again, it works. It's in the story.
It works, and it speaks well of Paul Savage as a character, where he's going to get the drop on the bad guy by like pulling the subterfuge on him, but he's so like scrupulously honest that even when he has the drop on the killer, he's going to explain to him not to gloat, just to be honest about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, I got the drop on you, but I have to admit I lied, and here's how I lied.
My bad. And ordinarily that would be kind of it. Mm. It would be kind of over. And they're talking about how, like, we've got this billionaire on attempted murder. There's no way he'll ever post bail. We'll talk about that in a second. Mm. And then they're going to run this story, and then the judge's wife shows up.
Mm.
And we've only seen her in, like, 1.5 scenes. And she says, I know you have a story you're running on my husband. I know he was cheating on me. I was going through some serious mental health issues, and I do not begrudge him a very minor dalliance in which I genuinely believe he never had sex with her.
Mm.
So if I don't care, and if the president, and listen, if the president of the United States of America would hear about all of this and decide he still wants this person on the Supreme Court, really, who are you to say that this person doesn't deserve...
Forgiveness.
Doesn't deserve forgiveness and doesn't deserve to be on the Supreme Court. Worth noting that when this episode came out, Richard Nixon would have been in office and all that shit that you saw in the movie The Post would have been out there. So this is not exactly like the president who's just like this like absolutely unassailable, non-divisive figure who everyone just agrees with and likes.
Morally upstanding, human being.
But Paul Savage points out he had put himself in a position to be influenced at the bench, potentially on the Supreme Court, by special interests directly, not just vaguely, not just because he's got biases because he's human, but because of blackmail material.
Mm.
Who's to say it won't happen again? Who's to say he won't cheat on you again and put himself in this exact same situation all over again?
The line is, when does the next girl come along?
Yeah. And she kind of looks at him and goes, she kind of like nods, that's a fair point, but I stand by this. And the whole argument is, surely this rich white man deserves infinite number of chances and deserves everything that he has been offered, even if he has done things in his past that could potentially make him absolutely the wrong person to be on the Supreme Court. At which point Paul Savage thinks about it, and when the opportunity comes along to ask the Supreme Court nominee a question and like break the story and make it a whole thing, he decides not to. And they decide to just go and run their next story again, and they're off to the next adventure.
And they run from the climax.
Yeah, because like, oh shit, we gotta go live in 20 minutes. Yeah. So we gotta get this
other story real fast.
I actually like that early on when they're talking about, they're investigating this guy and they don't know if there's a story yet. They talk about having a story on backup.
Yeah.
Just because they gotta run something.
It struck me as being very cynically 70s. This came out in 1973. This was around the time when a lot of cinema was turning very cynical and very, you know, I mentioned All the President's Men. Films like Five Easy Pieces and Easy Rider were already out there. And this mistrust of authority and this knowledge that everything was just sort of fundamentally broken was a big part of a lot of entertainment at the time.
Yeah.
So I didn't necessarily see this as Paul Savage forgiving him or giving him a pass. I saw it as him giving up.
See, I wish that had framed that way. If I feel like it had been framed as, like, I would like
he could confront this guy, but it wouldn't have done any good.
Here's how what I wish had been said. I think this is the sort of thing where if you want this to come across, it needs to be addressed. The wife comes in. And she says all of these things, and she tries to appeal to his better nature. She tries to appeal to his heart. Hey, you're an influential white man.
Yeah.
What, you know, if shit happened to you, wouldn't you want some forgiveness? Wouldn't you think you'd, you know, all that kind of stuff? And then when that doesn't work, she could point out, is anyone really going to give a shit that this guy cheated on somebody? It doesn't make him necessarily a bad judge. Nothing actually happened. It probably won't affect anything. And then he could just roll those dice or not. And you could get this story and you'll be a headline for a minute. And then 5 minutes later, something else is going to happen. You could address that.
Yeah.
And then that could be the point. And that would be a great point. And that would be fair. And that would be cynical. But the thing is that I feel like there's this inherent hopefulness here. The idea that this billionaire, who it didn't actually personally kill somebody, and just a flunky did it, so he's got some plausible deniability here, that this guy is of course going to jail and there's no follow-up. That's naive. We've got
that's the fantasy.
That's the fantasy. I get that's the fantasy, and we all want to believe that, but we also know, I think we even knew then, that that's not really how it worked all the time. And I realize now we're looking at it with contemporary goggles, where we're looking at, like, we just came off of this, like, staggeringly corrupt administration where people did genuinely corrupt things and then just got a presidential pardon openly, and shit.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just, and then, you know, there was an impeachment trial and a whole bunch of people were just like, in the Senate, were just like, yeah, but we don't care. Great. Thanks. America, everybody. Every movie that ever ended with, well, it's a good thing we got the evidence to, like, the courthouse, or that this will go, like, at the end of Clear and Present Danger, where Jack Ryan's going to speak in front of Congress, and we're going to take down this corrupt president.
We're going to expose everything, and now we've learned they just say it themselves now, and nobody cares, and people just fall in line.
So this kind of storyline doesn't really work very well right now in modern context. But I think even then, it's not quite bitter enough for me to have that impact. And I ultimately feel that because they frame it specifically around trying to, like, tug at Savage's heartstrings, and, like, here is this man who may have made a mistake, but it wasn't intentional, and we didn't actually do anything directly corrupt, and doesn't he deserve a chance? Richard Nixon thinks he deserves a chance, and he's an honorable man. Like, which is, gotta admit, might have been kind of funny even at the time, but it's hard to say. By appealing to that, it comes across as a little naive to me, and honestly made me like Paul Savage a little less as a character, because a part of me just wanted to be like, no, fuck it, do it. Do it. Fucking do it. This is all bullshit.
Tear it down.
Yeah. Tear it down, man. Like, a part of me was like, really wanted that renegade thing, but I guess we weren't there. I don't know. Yeah, maybe there was a cooler earlier draft and they just crunched it down.
No,
for
it
the
felt
studio.
Like it felt like because he's such a subdued character, Paul Savage.
Yeah.
That he wouldn't have done sort of the big dramatic thing. He wasn't sort of eager to give a big show of drama. He's a dramatic television personality.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's not going to necessarily go out of his way to make a scene. He's just going to do it when the story needs it.
Yeah.
I didn't see this as him softening at all. And in fact, he's taken to task that if we don't question this guy, he could be legitimately corrupted.
Yeah.
And
he decides to do it. What the hell? He decides to just let that happen.
Yeah. And he said,
weird.
And he doesn't have any sort of dialogue. I think he just sort of looks at her and then walks away. It's not like, yeah, you're right.
But then he has the opportunity where the judge himself literally says, like, hey, thank you for letting us interview you at the steps of your Senate hearing. And the judge literally looks to Savage and just says, is there anything you'd like to ask Mr. Savage? He gives him a chance.
Hmm.
And he would have had to deal with it. Yes, he has a scene with Savage earlier where Savage is telling him everything. Here's everything that's laid out. Here's why we think this story is important. And I know it's bad for you and that sucks for you, but this is the world. This is the country. This is the American judicial system. This is more important than that. And the guy says, a guy tries to explain himself. He says, I really don't think it was that big a deal. And he says, it's a free country. You can do whatever you want. I don't have to like it. Mm. And that's that. Like, I don't have, I'm not going to talk to you. I don't respect you for it. I disagree with you. And then he leaves. And so this judge is actually not like this cartoonishly evil person. And in the end, he gives Savage a chance. Here, yeah, go for it, man. This is your chance. Do it. It's your free country. And Savage doesn't. And it was just a little disappointed in Savage. And not in a cynical, you know, 1970s, like 3 days of the Condor ending kind of way. But right. It felt like it wasn't a very good ending to me. So that was a little disappointing. But overall, I really liked this.
Yeah, I like the character. I like the tone. I did like the very businesslike atmosphere of it. This would have made a great series.
I think so.
I think, you know, a really sort of famous investigative reporter just doing his job and doing it well.
Yeah.
And going into the scandal of the day, whatever the story was going to be. There's infinite stories you could milk out of this.
Yeah, instead of having a murder every single week like in Columbo, it's just some big news story. And maybe it's some kind of, you know, corruption scandal, or maybe it's some sort of big business thing that's going down, a big business deal that could change everyone's lives, or, you know, there are cars that are killing people and we have to look into this big cover-up, or basically anything you would see on 60 Minutes, we'll turn it into a show. Cool. You can say a lot with that. You can be really topical if you want. Like, shit, do that.
And you got a whole studio full of people who could be potential supporting characters, so you don't have to just have the central three.
Which is really
a central two, but
give the guy a little bit more stuff as the series goes on. But I really do think that taking this, and we've seen shows about news programs before, The Newsroom, which was frankly always a little insufferable. And by a little, I mean usually a lot. Mm. And that the problem with that one is that they're always trying to deal with like real news stories from about a year ago.
Yeah.
So it's easy to Monday morning quarterback that with the benefit of hindsight. Not that I'm saying everything was forgivable and everything that they covered in The Newsroom, but what I mean is when it's easy to have your characters always make the right call or always say the right thing if you are only looking back with the benefit of hindsight. Mm. So making up your own stories is actually a lot stronger, I think, in this kind of scenario. Yeah, it's cool. I like this. And I'm gonna say right now, cancel too soon.
I think so, too. I wish I could have seen more of this.
Yeah.
I wish I could have seen the team in action again. I can see why maybe it was looked over. You look at something like Columbo. Columbo has a lot of personality.
Yeah.
He's
eccentric. He's quirky.
Yeah, it's like a, hey, I'm investigating a murder. Can I lay down on your couch? It's like, what? Columbo, get your head in the game. Oh, it's been in the game this whole time. You sneaky Columbo.
Yeah.
You look at Rockford. Where Rockford is sort of this. I describe him as a playboy, maybe.
Yeah.
Paul Savage is maybe a little too serious a character to lead up a really kind of sensational investigation show.
Maybe.
I like that, but I like that kind of all business approach to a drama like this.
But that feels like a note you could have for as the series goes on. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, that was good for a pilot. We want a little bit more personality and a little bit more inner character dynamics. So let's just add like another person to the cast and like jazz up that aspect a little.
Well, what you need is this is a show populated entirely by straight men.
Yeah.
By
serious types.
Not cishet men. I meant
it's just all of the
really serious characters, and it could use a little levity.
Yeah.
So you cast like a young naive person who's a little bit lost, somebody you can kind of laugh along with.
Or you could have a thing where they are working at a TV station. There are network executives. Mm-hmm. And they might not always be working hand in hand with their show.
Indeed, we didn't mention Dabney Coleman.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about Dabney Coleman.
Who is, he's not the executive, but he's like Paul Savage's like boss.
Yeah.
The guy he like answers to. Dabney Coleman's in this for a few scenes.
Yeah. Dabney Coleman isn't the FBI agent he's talking to? Like cleaning out the pipe?
I thought he was like working for the station.
I thought that guy was. Anyway, this illustrates the point.
I'm getting it.
You know what? This illustrates the point here, where there's actually so much dialogue in the show, where maybe there isn't enough exposition, and maybe we aren't following along as clearly as we thought, because we both looked at the same character and thought he had a completely different job.
Okay. Well, you know what? I have these kinds of lapses in understanding all the time, so I'm the wrong. I accept openly that I'm wrong here.
We see these things once; they're not always in great condition. Sometimes the sound isn't great, and you have to concentrate a little harder because this is not like a well-preserved thing. This has never been released on DVD that I know of. This has never been, this is not on Blu-ray. This isn't
It did end up getting broadcast at one point.
Yeah, I said it aired on March 31st, 1973. It aired at least a couple more times on TV. Trio is a network that had a really good series, and we've used, recordings off of Trio for our material on more than one occasion. Trio had a series called Brilliant But Canceled, which is basically our show without us in it, where it's basically we just have these, all of these interesting shows that only lasted an episode or a couple of episodes, and now they're gone, but they're still interesting television, so Trio put them on the air. Thanks. That's cool. That's a great thing you did. Thank you, Trio. So there's a lot of shows that kind of only exists in online spaces because people recorded them off of Trio. And I'm grateful for that. This absolutely could have had legs. Obviously, Spielberg was done and going to move on and probably not return to the show. But I would have liked to have seen it. Martin Landau was really good in it. Barbara Bain was really good in it. Yeah. More Savage, please. That'd be fucking awesome. So, Spielberg. Turned out he had some talent.
Good for him. And he would go on to make The Post.
Yes.
No, I've seen The Post. I know how Steven Spielberg feels about Nixon.
Yeah. Well, and again, but that it's interesting, actually. This would actually be a really great double feature with The Post. Like, I would love that. If we could do, like, a double feature sort of retrospective where you take, like, you know, a filmmaker's really prominent work and then some obscure thing that they've done and, like, batch them up together, this would be an ideal double feature for Steven Spielberg. One, because you'd get to screen Savage for a lot of people who would ordinarily never get to see it. But two, because I think The Post is an excellent motion picture. Is it a little heavy-handed at times? Yeah, that's Spielberg for you. But it's really fucking good.
It's actually incredibly good. I've called it one of the defining pictures of the Trump era.
I think it's fair. I think it's fair to say. Yeah, and I think
it's Spielberg's last great film. His last film was Ready Player One, and I think that was abysmal. He hasn't made a film since. So,
he's got West Side Story coming up. That was supposed to be out already. So in another year it would have been out, but
it's coming. It's coming.
Yeah. So he does have another film on the horizon. It is a remake of West Side Story, and he's doing other stuff as well. So he's still working. He's a hardworking gentleman, and good for him. But yeah, The Post, if you missed it, I know a lot of people weren't in the mood because it seemed almost too topical, and all everyone was talking about for a long time was politics. Give it a watch or give it a rewatch if maybe you watched it and thought it was too soon. It's an excellent motion picture. And it tackles some of the same concepts and ideas as Savage. It's about the exact same era as Savage. Or a few years earlier, but regardless. And it's
less forgiving because it's a true story about speaking truth to power and how the people who have the information about a politician are actually doing their best to get that information to the public.
Yeah, and so that is important and valuable.
A good, and I think a better thought out counterpoint to Savage, which Agreed. Was clearly something Spielberg was kind of rushing through.
Well, it's a TV movie. Your
budget is low, your schedule is shorter.
Yeah, and again, you're trying to appease as many people as possible, and you're going off of what the network thinks will do that, which might explain why the ending, I feel, is a little bit of a cop-out. But there are worse sense, and it still doesn't torpedo the movie. I just don't like the ending very much. So if you ever get a chance to see Savage, highly recommended. We will be back next week with another show. Wait, what did you think? I was going to say. We won't be back.
We are intensely interested in the UPN.
Yes, we are.
Which until Quibi came along was the failinest network of all time.
Yeah.
Now it's Quibi.
UPN lost $800 million
over the course of its existence, which was about 10 years.
Yeah. Quibi lost about $1.7 billion in less than a year. Peacock lost about $900 million in less than a year, by the way. So I'm not sure how Peacock is gonna do, but maybe they'll pick their shit up.
My
point is UPN is no longer the failinest network.
No, but ever, yeah, they were like the most notorious for the longest time, and now we have like more recent examples. But they were trying all these different shows, and we've covered a few of them, and we would have covered more, but it's impossible to find these shows.
Yeah,
they're not on Paramount Plus.
No.
They should be.
Yeah,
they should have a UPN section, but they're not on Paramount Plus.
No.
And it's just they're really sweeping all of these shows under the rug. Just nobody has any interest in a lot of these UPN shows.
Well, again, failed TV, unless it has a noteworthy cult behind it, like something like Firefly or Twin Peaks, which was popular enough to come back. Unless there's some cachet, unless there are people who are still actively talking about it and, like, you know, demanding that this thing return, people just forget about it. They don't care. Yeah. They don't think anyone cares, and they don't bother releasing it.
People don't care. They don't bother actively releasing it. But occasionally, you know, they'll scatter these shows to the winds. The rights will go out to who knows who. There's some kid in college somewhere who's bought the rights to Special Unit 2. And... and she's just sitting on it somewhere, and we don't know where they're going to turn up. But
happy birthday! You're the rights to Platypus Man.
Yeah. So, oh, thank goodness! To something I've always wanted this. Because of the weird winds of popular culture, occasionally something like a little UPN prairie dog will pop its head up out of the ground, and we'll have access to it for a little bit. And that's the case this time because thanks to Tubi. Thank you, Tubi, for catching those prairie dogs. We're going to have access to Marker.
Yeah, it's one of the first shows. It debuted the second day UPN existed.
The first day was Star Trek Voyager.
Yep.
And they debuted, I think, like 4 sitcoms on the same day.
Yeah, I think Nowhere Man as well. And then we had Marker. And Marker stars Richard Grieco, who was still pretty well known from his time on 21 Jump Street.
And who had his own spinoff of 21 Jump Street.
Called Booker.
Booker, which I confuse with Marker.
For reasons that at the end in Kerr. Marker stars Richard Grieco as a construction worker who moves back to Hawaii after his billionaire father dies and ends up staying there because his billionaire father ended up giving hundreds of markers to people he met randomly in his travels. I guess all of whom live in Hawaii. And whenever they have a problem, they can, like, turn in their marker, and Richard Grieco is now obligated to help them.
Yeah, his billionaire father owed a lot of favors, and people have these markers. They're these little, like, crystal coins with a rose on them, and they come and say, hey, I got a marker. It's like, ah, damn it. Now I gotta help you. And Gates McFadden is highly, highly billed.
Yeah.
She was the second lead.
Gates McFadden, who was, of course, Dr. Beverly Crusher in Star Trek The Next Generation, so Whitney is extra excited.
Although, from what I understand, she's not in it a lot.
I've seen a couple of episodes already, and no. No, she is not. So she's a regular. She's in every episode, but she's not in it a lot. We'll see. Maybe it picks up. But yeah, so that's we finally tracked down Marker. Marker is finally available to all. Go to Tubi if you want and check out Marker. I understand some people aren't really fond of Tubi because it's owned by Fox and its proceeds go to Fox News. But it is free. You don't actually have to click on any of the commercials. And I'll say this for Tubi. Their selection is wild. They have a lot of weird stuff.
We've compared them to a video store before, and Tubi's like the really awesome independently run video store that like just scavenged the like couple other dead video stores and compiled them all together.
Yeah. So
they got some classics, a lot of cult movies, a lot of weird TV stuff.
Yeah, a lot of 70s horror shit. Mm-hmm. Like they just got everything. So and somehow, I don't know how I even noticed, they have Marker.
And they have Marker.
So we're going to be doing Marker. So thank you to everyone who gave us Marker. We finally get to do some more UPN shows, and we're going to be doing Marker. So thank you, everybody, for that. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, everybody, for subscribing. Please subscribe if you haven't already. It really helps us out a lot. If you haven't had the time to leave us a review, wherever you find us, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, wherever you find us, please do. It really helps us find a bigger audience. It helps people, like, when they're searching for things, run across our show and maybe find it. And then we get more listeners, and then we're able to do more. We would love to do more. That always helps. Leave us a review. If you really want to help the show out a lot, you can go to our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where we offer a variety of tiers to help support the show. If you can afford it, we get you a ton of exclusive content on top of content. Ton of exclusive podcasts.
Thank you.
Trying to eliminate content.
Stop referring to hard work and art as content.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So it's like it's trying to do that. Sorry. But we get a lot of podcasts. We get podcasts dedicated to Batman, podcasts dedicated to Star Trek, podcasts dedicated to Disney, the Academy Awards, commentary tracks, a whole bunch of stuff just unlocks at any Patreon tier. So if you can afford to help out, that would be really great, and we'd love to have you. And a very special shout out to all of our current patrons, without whom this show would simply not exist. We'd be gone.
Thank you so much for being here and listening to us and helping us to indulge in these weird interests of ours.
Yeah, and to everyone who has already checked out our Etsy store, I want to give a special thank you. We've actually done rather well for like a store that just started out on Etsy. M. Lapis de Silva, my wife and partner, and I started a soap business. We have designer soaps that are crafted. So far, they're all crafted by M. Lapis de Silva, but there's a wide variety of really awesome designs. They all smell amazing. If you go to Etsy and search for Salt Cat Soap, all one word, Salt Cat Soap, you can look for the logo that looks like Luca. Michelle designed that as well. We're also on Twitter and Instagram at Salt Cat Soap. And there's a lot of really, really cool designs, including my favorite right now is a birthday cake soap that was her birthday gift to me. And it smells like birthday cake, and it's a wonderful soap, and I hope you enjoy it. So thank you, everybody who's already checked that out. We're on Twitter, at Critic Acclaim. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
And if you want to write us an email, the email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And we might read your email in an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. Talk about anything you want to talk about, something we discuss on this podcast, TV, movie history, our opinions on things, whatever you want us, we'll talk about it. We're here for you. So thank you, everybody, and we'll see you next season.